Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. I spoke with David Waltner Taze, author of Eat the Beetles. David is a writer specializing in ecosystem approaches to health and disease. He's also the founding president of Veterinarians Without Borders.
I've been vaguely aware of people eating insects for decades because I hitchhiked through Southeast Asia in the late 1960s. So I'd seen people eating, but it didn't kind of register. And then in 2000, the early part of this millennium, I was part of setting up Veterinarians Without Borders in Canada. And one of the things that happened was that our coordinator in Laos, in Southeast Asia, started a project for raising crickets for human consumption. For small farmers, particularly women, they could grow crickets in the backyard and raise them for extra protein. And about the same time, let's say, what are we now, 2018, so 4 or 5 years ago, the Food and Agriculture Organization and various other groups had these major international conferences raising the possibility of insect as a sustainable food source globally. So I kind of knew about it in Southeast Asia, and then this pushed it to a whole new level. And I'd spent my career as an epidemiologist looking at diseases people get from animals. So in that context, insects were mostly bad. They're carrying diseases, right? Insect and other arthropods. So they're carrying Lyme disease, or they're carrying West Nile virus, or those sorts of things. And it was a bit of a head spin on me. And I thought, well, I should investigate this and see what's going on, because I spent part of my career figuring out how to kill them so they don't spread disease, and now I'm supposed to think about them. I'm supposed to try to keep insects healthy so that we can eat them. And so I started investigating that, and that's what got me involved in looking at it more carefully and trying to understand the world of insects and related arthropods, not just as food, but it's also then related to, if we're trying to kill them, then we can't eat them. If you're spraying poisons to try to kill them on the crops, then you either have to eat the crops or you have to eat the insects. You can't do both in the same place. Those kind of issues are of interest to me because they're not easily resolvable, and they require some rethinking of how we do agriculture, how we grow food, what we want for food, those kinds of things.
Yeah, right.
That was a long answer to a short question.
Well, part three of your book, the title is Insects as Destroyers and Monsters, and one of the sections is The War Against Insects. So I guess you've
right.
talked about that. So I understand it's a bit of a head spin, and I hear what you're saying. If you're going to spray something, and this is a big concern with any food product, if we're
right.
going to spray it to try and quote-unquote protect it, then what are the after effects? What are we ingesting along with
So in North America, I mean, we don't have a tradition of eating insects in North America and Europe. That's true in most northern temperate climate areas, and there's a whole range of reasons for that. If you go further south, it becomes more. I mean, here we can raise them on farms. We can raise crickets on farms and so on. In a few years ago, there was a big locust plague in Madagascar, for instance. And one of the possibilities for dealing with it was for people to gather the locusts, cook them up, and eat them. And there's a tradition for kids gathering them up and people eating them. But a lot of the locusts were destroying cash crops, were for sale, and so the big institutional recommendations were we've got to spray the locusts, we've got to kill them. But if you spray the crops to kill them, then the people can't use them as food. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you're saving a crop to generate money, but on the other hand, you're destroying a food source that people can use. And at some point, you have to make a decision. You can't do both in that context. You have to have kind of designed a system around being able to do both. It's possible to do it, but it takes some... you can't do it in the crisis. You have to stand back and redesign how we grow food, what we consider to be food.
Is there a trade-off between, well, how much do we let the insects eat the crop before we harvest them, or is there
it's interesting.
Balance?
If you think of locusts as animals, which they are, mm-hmm. As a veterinarian, that wasn't something that registered with me until I started working on this book. They are animals. We graze cattle on pastures. The cattle eat the grass, and then we eat the cattle, or we drink the milk. Why couldn't we do the same thing with locusts that are eating grassland crops? Well, part of the reason is we've developed a whole infrastructure for managing, let's say, milk products from cattle. We've got a cold chain, we've got ways of processing it, we've got ways of storing it, whether it's through cheese or yogurt or other kinds of things. We don't have traditions for how to preserve insects, and that's, for instance, when the situation in Madagascar came about, if they could have found a way to gather the locusts and then preserve them in some way. But then you need to, dry them, you need to process them, you need to do something so that they don't just rot. Mm-hmm. In the fields or in the houses, they start fermenting, they start rotting, they stink. You have to gather them while they're fresh, and then you have to find some way to preserve them. And we haven't developed that. It doesn't say we couldn't. It just means you have to do that before you get to the crisis. You have to say, okay, we've got a crop of locusts here. Let's bring them in and let's put them through this processing plant. But the plant has to be there, or right. The processes, people have to have, ovens or some way to manage those locusts.
Right. Also, in your book, you talk about the fact that we have evolved from hunter-gatherers to culture of agriculture, of
right.
managing animal resources for consumption. So we've learned to do that with certain animals, and also other animals like dogs and cats. Most of us shy away from that kind of a thing. So there's this divide between what's edible and what's not edible. And
right. You're
saying now we should consider certain insects, not all of them, but certain insects for their nutritional value.
People have only started to study the actual nutritional value of insects, or what the fat content and protein and iron and trace minerals and those kinds of things. There are traditions of people eating them, and we know that they're a source of reasonably good nutrition. A lot of that is culture-specific and local, and it's been based on foraging. Now, foraging works well if you don't have huge population pressures. If there's a billion people in the world, that's one thing. If you got 6 or 7 billion people, then suddenly if there's a market for something that you can forage, something that was sustainable a century ago becomes destructive, because you've got everybody out in the forest breaking down trees, trying to get at the bugs so that they can sell them. And that becomes a problem. So then you say, well, are there ways that we can farm them? Not all insects are farmable, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Some of them have their own self-perpetuating communities. Termites are like that. It's hard to put termites into a farm. It's easier to gather them when they're in the field, out in the dry lands. And there are parts of the world where people eat termites, and they're a good source of protein and fat and iron and a few other things. Bees are in that same kind of group where they're self-organizing. They're almost like a superorganism. And we've tried to put them into industrial farming. They don't actually fit that well. We put them into boxes and then use them for pollination. They're really one of the reasons we run into problems with bees getting sick and having pests and so on is that they're really more wild and self-organizing than they are domesticated. The insects that seem to do best are ones that are can be in large groups, but they don't necessarily organize themselves into communities. So, crickets directly for human consumption, they reproduce like crazy. You can raise them in the same kinds of barns that you raise chickens in. The other way that insects come into the food system is through animal feeds to chickens and feeds to farmed fish, for instance. In BC, in British Columbia, in Langley, BC, there's a company called Enterra Feeds. And the stimulus for them was actually a discussion that David Suzuki had with a businessman, an entrepreneur, Brad Marchand. And they were out fishing and talking about, you know, this should be a better way to feed farmed fish and also chickens for that matter. What are we feeding them now? Well, a major source of protein has been to take anchovies, wild fish, from off the coast of Peru, process them, fly them up here, and then feed them to farm fish, which seems crazy. I mean, it's crazy from the wild fish point of view, and it's crazy from doing that here. And what happened was that the city of Vancouver outlawed the dumping of organic waste from large grocery stores into landfills. They said you have to do something else with it. You can generate compost, generate electricity, whatever you like. And Brad Marchand and David Suzuki helped this guy set up a company. Brad Marchand actually set it up to take this organic waste. They were paid to take the waste from these grocery stores. They grew fly larvae on it. The flies are soldier flies, which I thought sounds bad, but soldier flies are actually, the adults don't do anything really. They just breed. And the larvae normally feed on detritus, like organic waste in forest floors. So they were raise these larvae on waste from grocery stores. They would generate good protein, good fat, and then they use that as animal feed back to chickens and farmed fish. Now, whatever one thinks of commercial chicken production or farmed fish, and there are problems with both of those, that certainly is a way to shorten that ecological cycle and close a loop in there. So that's one of the ways that insects have already gotten into our food system, and it's probably the easiest way. So you got flies that reproduce, you know, like crazy, but they're not organized in communities. So you can raise them in a barn as long as you've got a reasonably closed system. Same thing with crickets. I mean, the big cricket farm outside of Peterborough in Ontario, in Tomo Farms, or they used to be called Next Millennium Farms, they've taken old chicken barns and repurposed them for raising crickets, and it works just fine. So, yeah, they jump around all over the place, but if you've got a closed barn, chickens will run all over the place, too, yeah. if you put them out on pasture, and that's fine if you're doing free-range chickens. Crickets, it would be much harder to harvest them in the field than it is out of a barn.
Let's talk about the nutritional value of insects. And pound for pound, how does that compare to, say, your average cattle?
Insects in general tend to fall into where fish and chicken would be. So high protein, tend to be low fat. But there's variation. One of the things that struck me when I started looking at insects was there are millions of species. There are more species of insect than there are of any other kind of animal on the planet. There are more species of beetle, which is one part of insects, than there are of, there's 15,000 species of mammals, but there's 360,000 species of beetles, more or less. People, there are new ones being added. So there's a lot of variation. Some of them are high in iron or zinc. Most of them don't have high saturated fats, but there are a few, like palm weevil larvae and termites that do have high saturated fats, which is fine if you're in sub-Saharan Africa and you need a good fat source as well as a protein source. In North America, we certainly don't need, you know, more fat content in our food. So there's a lot of variation. And the ones that have been picked up in North America for eating have mealworms, which are actually larvae of darkling beetles, which are beetles. There's a whole range of different beetles that feed on detritus on floors and things like that, forest floor, or in they actually feed on. There are certain species that feed on the stuff that they put on the flooring in chicken barns, so they can be a pest in chicken barns. But there are other species. They take the larvae and then they cook them up. They roast them, and they can either grind them up or you can have them straight up, fried with a bit of, you know, chilies and things like that. If you select particular species, and that's starting to happen, there are different. It depends what you want them for, right? So there are, because there are such a range of insects, some of them are easier to manage than others. Some of them have higher protein or I won't say more fat or less fat, but they have fewer saturated fats. Ants are an interesting case in point because they do create colonies. I mean, they're in the same general grouping among insects as bees and hornets and termites are, but they you can harvest them in small amounts, and people use them as a garnish, where they're a little bit spicy because they've got acetic acid in them, and they give it a little bit of. I've had them on salmon and so on. And it gives it a little bit of almost spiciness to it.
It seems to raise the question of regulation. I'm trying to imagine the Canadian Food Inspection Agency trying to get ahead of this curve. And
yeah, and that was one of the issues. I talked to the manager, Andrew Vickerson, out at Interra Feeds in BC, and there was a huge amount of paperwork because they weren't used to it. It was easier in... Well, there were a number of things that went on. First of all, there were insect farms growing insects for pets. So people had pet lizards, pet snakes, those kind of things. They would go to a pet store and buy crickets, things like that, to feed to their pets at home. So there were some farmers already doing that, so there was some basis for regulation. As soon as you get it into the human food chain, it creates problems. The biggest challenges I saw were actually in the European Union, which, because of mad cow disease, had passed a law that said that you couldn't feed any animals to other animals. In Canada, we said we couldn't feed ruminants to other ruminants. So you couldn't take waste from a cattle slaughter plant and cook it up and make a protein concentrate and feed it back to cattle. In Europe, they extended that, and they said, with the exception of fish, that was the only... You could take fish meal and feed it to other animals, but you couldn't take any other animal. And when they made the regulations, they weren't thinking of insects. But when the insect producers started producing their stuff, they ran up against these regulations. And the regulator said, well, yeah, they're animals, so you can't even feed insects to other animals, never mind feeding them to people. And there's been a lot of back and forth, and since the book came out earlier this year, there have been some shifts, and they've allowed insects in some cases to be used under special regulations. But it's one of those things that nobody's quite sure how that's going to play out. And it's because, again, because they're animals, and it's... people in Western culture, we haven't thought of them as food, and so we haven't, when the people that designed the regulations were thinking cattle, chickens, pigs, goats, sheep, they were not thinking crickets, mealworms, palm weevil larvae, that kind of stuff. And that's creating all kinds of headaches from the regulatory side. You know, what's if the fly's larvae are supposed to be on the pizza, then what happens to a health inspector who comes in and sees flies in the kitchen? I mean, it's, yeah, they're supposed to be there, right? They're part of the food, but the traditional view is if there are flies in the kitchen, then they're a health hazard. So that needs to be worked out. That stuff is all up in the air. I think what's happened is that people that raise them and roast them and sell them as snack food, and that has tended to be what's happened in North America, have had an easier time than people are trying to do other things with them, and there have been kind of informal networks of people doing stuff below the radar. As long as they don't commercialize and make money on it or sell it to other people, then it's okay, right? It's a little bit like, you know, drinking raw milk. As long as you're not selling it to make money, then you're not necessarily regulated in the same way. And that's kind of the way I think things are developing, except for these the snack foods and the roasts and so on.
In the few minutes we have left, what stage are we at in the adoption of raising, grooming, eating insects? What stage are we at?
It's one of the things that I noticed as I was working on the book, and I see it continuing, is that there are a huge number of startups, people that have seen this as an opportunity. It's been promoted internationally. And there have been a lot of startups, and a lot of them have disappeared. You know, I would see a website, I would contact the people, but the company would be gone by the time I got there. Some of those will stick, but it takes, because it's a transition period in terms of food adoption, it'll take some financial input, there are transaction costs to raising them. So somebody that has chicken barns or has been raising them for pets already has some knowledge and some infrastructure in order to deal with it. There was a few years ago, there was a big epidemic of a virus that went through and basically decimated a lot of the cricket growers. They had expanded very rapidly, and they hadn't thought about, I mean, they're animals, they get diseases, and there was a particular virus that went through and wiped them out. That's one of the reasons that the people, the larger farm in Peterborough, that they switched to a different type of cricket that is not as susceptible to that virus. But that kind of stuff hasn't been, if you look at the international regulations on animal diseases of insects, except for bees, have not been regulated, because they thought of insects as being one of the things that they wanted to regulate rather than being something that they wanted to protect from getting viruses or fungi or some other something else that would be spread among them. So the other thing that's happening, and which is changing how this is perceived, and the way I tend to look at it, is in a multicultural setting. So that there are a lot of people in Canada now who come from all over the world. They come from Somalia, they come from Uganda, they come from Southeast Asia, India, China, and they may have eaten insects in their home country, but they tend to stay below the radar here. If you talk to them, they say, oh yeah, when I go back to Uganda, I'll eat termites, but around here, there's not quite a shame, but a hesitancy to want to do that because it's seen as being backward, or they're already trying to fit in, and what does it mean to fit in? Well, it means you eat KFC or hamburgers or something like that. And I think that's shifting. It's going to take some time. What may help, actually, is the big push to get Canada's Indigenous peoples, First Nations, more, give them higher profile, give them so that they're more engaged, because they've gone through very similar sorts of things where their traditional foods have been kind of shamed into the background. Well, we don't eat those kind of fermented seal blubber or whale blubber or salmon eggs or something like that. To mainstream that, and then you start seeing, well, there are these other things too. There are different kind of insects from different parts of the world, and it becomes part of a more diverse diet rather than being, well, can insects replace chickens or replace cattle? I think the way I think of it as a best case scenario is everybody eats a lot fewer cattle, chickens, those sorts of things, and we eat a more diverse diet. So, you know, we might eat, some people are vegetarian, but we also eat different kinds of protein sources, including different kinds of insects. And it's not a matter so much of, you know, can crickets replace cows or sheep or chickens? It's, can they take the pressure off of that system so that the farmers there don't have this incentive, in fact, to go to, you know, economies of scale and intensification and all those things that cause problems in agriculture in general. But people have a more diverse expectation that's related to sort of cultural diversity, that there's sort of mutual respect for different kinds of culinary backgrounds. And to me, it's more embedded in that sense of living in a diverse planet that's culturally diverse and diverse kinds of food sources, rather than focusing on one thing and can we replace this with that. If you simply replace insects, you put insects into the same industrial large-scale economies of scale, then we haven't, I don't think, solved the problem. We've maybe lessened the pressure or shifted a little bit, but we're going to end up with very similar kind of problems as we have now with other species. And that one of the points I make in my book is that this is probably the first time that we in North America, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, sort of the post-colonial countries, have a chance to think about what are we going to eat and how are we going to eat it, in terms of animal feeds. Because traditionally, we kind of inherited cattle and pigs and chickens. I mean, they, you know, over thousands of years, different people used them, and we just kind of said, well, how can we do this more efficiently? And so we didn't think about, you know, what about the wild populations? What about other species? But here now we're looking at, oh, well, there are these other species. What good are they? What are they doing in the wild? We don't want to destroy species of insect that are doing all kinds of intricate pollination and practices in the wild that are sustaining the ecosystems of which we're part. So we can do this more self-consciously, and that's what I was trying to do in the book, was say, let's look at this whole world of arthropods and insects, which ones are better for eating, which ones are culturally specific, which ones grow only in certain areas. In southern Africa, they have these mopane worms, which are caterpillars of emperor moths, that grow only in certain landscapes. And so simply foraging can be very destructive. They're not really well farmed, but if you set up some sort of cooperative program where different villages manage a forest that where these grow, then you can do it sustainably. But that requires a different way of thinking about agriculture rather than simply, you know, some big company owns this farm and they mass produce it. So to me, it's interesting and it's exciting because of the way it embeds in our sense of living on a diverse and interesting planet.
David Waltner-Tieves, author of Eat the Beetles, An Exploration into Our Conflicted Relationship with Insects. Thank you for joining us on Earth Matters.
You're very welcome.
Eat the Beetles is published by ECW Press here in Canada.